Chapter 4. Take up his burden, silently and sorrowfully, and to bear it henceforth with the quietness of despair. But we can perceive that he scarcely possessed the strength and fortitude needful for success in such an attempt. And clearly Shelley himself was aware how perilous it was to accept that respite of blissful ease which he enjoyed in the Boinville household. For gentle voices and dewy looks, and words of sympathy could not fail to remind him of an ideal of tranquility, or of joy which could never be his, and which he must henceforth sternly exclude from his imagination. That paragraph commits the author in no way. Taken sentence by sentence, it asserts nothing against anybody or in favor of anybody, pleads for nobody, accuses nobody. Taken detail by detail, it is as innocent as moonshine. And yet, taken as a whole, it is a design against the reader. Its intent is to remove the feeling which the letter must leave with him if let alone, and put a different one in its place, to remove a feeling justified by the letter, and substitute one not justified by it. The letter itself gives you no uncertain picture. No lecturer is needed to stand by with a stick and point out its details, and led on to explain what they mean. The picture is a very clear, and remorsefully faithful picture of a fallen, and fettered angel who is ashamed of himself. An angel who beats his soiled wings and cries, who complains to the woman who enticed him, that he could have borne his wayward lot, he could have stood by his duty, if it had not been for her beguilements. An angel who rails at the boundless ocean of abhorred society, and rages at his poor judicious sister-in-law. If there is any dignity about this spectacle, it will escape most people. Yet when the paragraph of comment is taken as a whole, the picture is full of dignity and pathos. We have before us a blameless and noble spirit stricken to the earth by malign powers, but not conquered, tempted, but grandly putting the temptation away, enmeshed by subtle coils, but sternly resolved to rend them, and march forth victorious, at any peril of life or limb. Curtain slow music. Was it the purpose of the paragraph to take the bad taste of Shelley's letter out of the reader's mouth? If that was not it, good ink was wasted. Without that, it has no relevancy. The multiplication table would have padded the space as rationally. We have inspected the six reasons which we are asked to believe drove a man of conspicuous patience, honor, justice, fairness, kindliness, and iron firmness, resolution, and steadfastness, from the wife whom he loved, and who loved him, to a refuge in the mephitic paradise of Bracknell. These are six infinitely little reasons, but there were six colossal ones, and these the counsel for the destruction of Harriet Shelley persists in not considering very important. Moreover, the colossal six preceded the little six, and had done the mischief, before they were born. Let us double column the 12, then we shall see at a glance, that each little reason is in turn answered by a retorting reason of a size to overshadow it, and make it insignificant. 1. Harriet sets up carriage. 1. Cornelia Turner. 2. Harriet stops studying. 2. Cornelia Turner. 3. Harriet goes to bonnet shop. 3. Cornelia Turner. 4. Harriet takes a wet nurse. 4. Cornelia Turner. 5. Harriet has too much nerve. 5. Cornelia Turner. 6. Detested sister-in-law. 6. Cornelia Turner. As soon as we comprehend that Cornelia Turner and the Italian lessons happened before the little six had been discovered to be grievances, we understand why Shelley's happiness in his home had been wounded and bruised almost to death, and no one can persuade us into laying it on Harriet. Shelley and Cornelia are the responsible persons, and we cannot in honor and decency allow the cruelties which they practiced upon the unoffending wife to be pushed aside in order to give us a chance to waste time and tears over six sentimental justifications of an offense which the six can't justify, nor even respectably assist in justifying. 6. There were 7, but in charity to the biographer the 7th ought not to be exposed. Still, he hung it out himself, and not only hung it out, but thought it was a good point in Shelley's favor. For 2 years Shelley found sympathy and intellectual food and all that at home. There was enough for spiritual and mental support, but not enough for luxury. And so, at the end of the contented 2 years, this latter detail justifies him in going bag and baggage over to Cornelia Turner, and supplying the rest of his need in the way of surplus sympathy and intellectual pie unlawfully. By the same reasoning, a man in merely comfortable circumstances may rob a bank without sin. 3. It is 1814. It is the 16th of March. Shelley has written his letter. He has been in the Boinville paradise a month. His deserted wife is in her husbandless home. Mischief had been wrought. It is the biographer who concedes this. We greatly need some light on Harriet's side of the case now. We need to know how she enjoyed the month, but there is no way to inform ourselves. There seems to be a strange absence of documents, and letters and diaries on that side. Shelley kept a diary, the approaching Mary Godwin kept a diary, her father kept one, her half-sister by marriage, adoption, and the dispensation of God kept one, and the entire tribe and all its friends wrote and received letters, and the letters were kept, and are producible when this biography needs them. But there are only 3 or 4 scraps of Harriet's writing, and no diary. Harriet wrote plenty of letters to her husband, nobody knows where they are, I suppose. She wrote plenty of letters to other people, apparently they have disappeared too. Peacock says she wrote good letters, but apparently interested people had sagacity enough to mislay them in time. After all her industry she went down into her grave and lies silent there, silent, when as he has so much need to speak. We can only wonder at this mystery, not account for it. No, there is no way of finding out what Harriet's state of feeling was during the month that Shelley was disporting himself in the Bracknell paradise. We have to fall back upon conjecture, as our fabulist does, when he has nothing more substantial to work with. Then we easily conjecture that as the days dragged by, Harriet's heart grew heavier and heavier under its 2 burdens, shame and resentment. The shame of being pointed at and gossiped about as a deserted wife, and resentment against the woman who had beguiled her husband from her and now kept him in a disreputable captivity. Deserted wives deserted, whether for cause or without cause, find small charity among the virtuous and the discreet. We conjecture that one after another the neighbors ceased to call, that one after another they got to be engaged when Harriet called, that finally they one after the other cut her dead on the street, that after that she stayed in the house daytimes, and brooded over her sorrows, and nighttimes did the same, there being nothing else to do with the heavy hours, and the silence and solitude and the dreary intervals which sleep should have charitably bridged, but didn't. Yes, mischief had been wrought. The biographer arrives at this conclusion, and it is a most just one. Then, just as you begin to half hope he is going to discover the cause of it, and launch hot bolts of wrath at the guilty manufacturers of it, you have to turn away disappointed. You are disappointed, and you sigh. This is what he says, the italics are mine. However the mischief may have been wrought, and at this day, no one can wish to heap blame on any buried head, so it is poor Harriet after all. Stern justice must take its course, justice tempered with delicacy, justice tempered with compassion, justice that pities a forlorn dead girl and refuses to strike her, except in the back. Will not be ignoble, and say the harsh thing, but only insinuate it. Stern justice knows about the carriage, and the wet nurse and the bonnet shop and the other dark things that caused this sad mischief, and may not, must not link them, so it delivers judgment where judgment belongs, but softens the blow by not seeming to deliver judgment at all. To resume, the italics are mine. However the mischief may have been wrought, and at this day no one can wish to heap blame on any buried head, it is certain that some cause or causes of deep division between Shelley and his wife were in operation during the early part of the year 1814. This shows penetration. No deduction could be more accurate than this. there were indeed some causes of deep division. But next comes another disappointing sentence. Oh, guess at the precise nature of these cafes, in the absence of definite statement, were useless. Why, he has already been guessing at them for several pages, and we have been trying to outguess him, and now all of a sudden he is tired of it, and won't play anymore. It is not quite fair to us. However, he will get over this by and by, when Shelley commits his next indiscretion, and has to be guessed out of it at Harriet's expense. We may rest content with Shelley's own words in a chancery paper drawn up by him 3 years later. They were these: colon delicacy forbids me to say more than that we were disunited by incurable dissensions. As for me, I do not quite see why we should rest content with anything of the sort. It is not a very definite statement. It does not necessarily mean anything more than that he did not wish to go into the tedious details of those family quarrels. Delicacy could quite properly excuse him from saying, I was in love with Cornelia all that time. My wife kept crying and worrying about it, and upbraiding me, and begging me to cut myself free from a connection which was wronging her, and disgracing us both. And I, being stung by these reproaches, retorted with fierce and bitter speeches, for it is my nature to do that when I am stirred, especially if the target of them is a person whom I had greatly loved and respected before, as witness my various attitudes towards Miss Hitchener, the Gisburns, Harriet's sister, and others. And finally, I did not improve this state of things when I deserted my wife and spent a whole month with the woman who had infatuated me. No, he could not go into those details, and we excuse him. But, nevertheless, we do not rest content with this bland proposition. To puff away that whole long disreputable episode with a single mean, meaningless remark of Shelley's. We do admit that T is certain that some cause or causes of deep division were in operation. We would admit it just the same, if the grammar of the statement were as straight as a string, for we drift into pretty indifferent grammar ourselves when we are absorbed in historical work. But we have to decline to admit that we cannot guess those cause or causes. But guessing is not really necessary. There is evidence, attainable evidence, from the batch discredited by the biographer and set out at the back door in his appendix basket. And yet a court of law would think twice before throwing it out, whereas it would be a hardy person who would venture to offer in such a place a good part of the material which is placed before the readers of this book as evidence, and so treated by this daring biographer. Among some letters in the appendix basket, from Mrs. Godwin, detailing the Godwinian share in the Shelleyan events of 1814, she tells how Harriet Shelley came to her and her husband, agitated and weeping, to implore them to forbid Shelley the house, and prevent his seeing Mary Godwin. He related that last November he had fallen in love with Mrs. Turner, and paid her such marked attentions. Mr. Turner, the husband, had carried off his wife to Devonshire. The biographer finds a technical fault in this. The Shelleys were in Edinburgh in November. What of that? The woman is recalling a conversation which is more than 2 months old. Besides, she was probably more intent upon the central and important fact of it than upon its unimportant date. Harriet's quoted statement has some sense in it. For that reason, if for no other, it ought to have been put in the body of the book. Still, that would not have answered. Even the biographer's enemy could not be cruel enough to ask him to let this real grievance, this compact and substantial and picturesque figure, this raw head and bloody bones, come striding in there among those pale shams, those rickety specters labeled wet nurse, bonnet shop, and so on. No, the father of all malice could not ask the biographer to expose his pathetic goblins to a competition like that. The fabulist finds fault with the statement because it has a technical error in it. And he does this at the moment that he is furnishing us an error himself, and of a graver sort. He says, F. Turner carried off his wife to Devonshire. He brought her back, and Shelley was staying with her and her mother on terms of cordial intimacy in March, 1814. We accept the ordeal intimacy. It was the very thing Harriet was complaining of, but there is nothing to show that it was Turner who brought his wife back. The statement is thrown in, as if it were not only true, but was proof, that Turner was not uneasy. Turner's movements are proof of nothing. Nothing but a statement from Turner's mouth would have any value here, and he made none. 6 days after writing his letter, Shelley and his wife were together again for a moment to get remarried according to the rites of the English Church. Within 3 weeks the new husband and wife were apart again, and the former was back in his odorous paradise. This time it is the wife who does the deserting. She finds Cornelia too strong for her, probably. At any rate, she goes away with her baby and sister, and we have a playful fling at her from good Mrs. Boinville, the mysterious spinner Mimuna, she whose ace was as a damsel's face, and yet her hair was gray, she of whom the biographer has said, Shelley was indeed caught in an almost invisible thread spun around him, but unconsciously, by this subtle and benignant enchantress. The subtle and benignant enchantress writes to Hogg, April 18, Shelley is again a widower. His bodious half went to town on Thursday. Then Shelley writes a poem, a chant of grief over the hard fate which obliges him now to leave his paradise and take up with his wife again. It seems to intimate that the paradise is cooling towards him, that he is warned off by acclamation, that he must not even venture to tempt with one last tear his friend Cornelia's ungentle mood, for her eye is glazed and cold and dares not entreat her lover to stay. Exhibit he us not, the time is past. Every voice cries away. Apostrophe tempt not with one last tear thy friend's ungentle mood. Thy lover's eye, so glazed and cold, dares not entreat thy stay. Duty and dereliction guide thee back to solitude. Back to the solitude of his now empty home, that is. Way, away, to thy sad and silent home, pour bitter tears on its desolated hearth. But he will have rest in the grave by and by. Until that time comes, the charms of Bracknell will remain in his memory, along with Mrs. Boinville's voice and Cornelia Turner's smile. Who in the grave shall rest yet, till the phantoms flee which that house and hearth and garden made dear to the ear, while thy remembrance and repentance and deep musings are not free from the music of two voices, and the light of one sweet smile. We cannot wonder that Harriet could not stand it. Any of us would have left. We would not even stay with a cat that was in this condition. Even the Boinvilles could not endure it. And so, as we have seen, they gave this one notice. Early in May, Shelley was in London. He did not yet despair of reconciliation with Harriet, nor had he ceased to love her. Shelley's poems are a good deal of trouble to his biographer. They are constantly inserted as tridents, and they make much confusion. As soon as one of them has proved one thing, another one follows and proves quite a different thing. The poem just quoted shows that he was in love with Cornelia, but a month later he is in love with Harriet again, and there is a poem to prove it. In this piteous appeal Shelley declares that he has now no grief but one, the grief of having known and lost his wife's. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.